Welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. I'm glad to be here with you guys today on, as we record, a sunny, beautiful day in February. Hello, Burl.
How are you doing, Sherry? Are you working on your tan today? It's like going to be 70 degrees and sunny on February 15th.
Burl, it's podcast day and there's city council. No.
No,
our special guest today, which I hate when we forget to announce it, that's always on me when I do, is, you guys got to keep listening for sure, is Cincinnati Director of Athletics, John Cunningham. And we are going to talk about all things UC, you know, nothing going on up there. So I'm so excited to talk to him.
No, that'll be great. I have many, many questions. And there's so much going on there right now with, you know, UC officially entering the Big 12 in a Power 5 conference. They've got all kinds of things happening on campus. They've got a new football coach. So we have a list. We have a list of questions we're going to be asking John Cunningham.
We do. But, you know, we always do talk about like news of the week. We do try and stick to the politics of things. And there's only one thing on my mind, honestly, and obviously all things City Hall, but there's only one thing really on my mind as a citizen of Ohio and a girl who grew up in Youngstown, and that's the train derailment in East Palestine.
Yeah, let's spend a little bit of time talking about that. The first thing that I think we might talk about is how the, you know, this story is not new. On February 3rd, there was a train derailment in East Palestine, Ohio, which is, as you mentioned, near Youngstown. It's kind of northeast, right along the Pennsylvania border. And there was, you know, hazardous chemicals spilled. And the officials said that they were handling it. They were going to release the chemicals in a controlled burn. And it was almost back to business as usual. And then, you know, the story got substantially bigger. You had residents complaining about their health concerns, fish dying in streams. That controlled burn looked more like a giant explosion and black smoke plumes going into the sky. And now tonight, there's a town hall where residents are hopefully going to get some answers. And we actually have journalists from the Cincinnati Inquirer, our partner, the Columbus Dispatch, on the ground to cover the story. So it's one of those stories that I think is not going to go away quickly because so many lines of accountability need to be addressed. Norfolk Southern, what's their safety record? What could they have done to avoid the crash?
I do want to say it's Norfolk Southern Rail. So they run the railroad. Their private cars were carrying the chemicals that we're talking about. There's five cars that derailed. They all had some sort of chemical in them. I can't even pronounce the name of the chemicals, but that's, you know, typical with chemicals. So, but Norfolk Southern really is at the center of this because it's their rail line.
That's correct. But there's also, you know, the accountability with the EPA and even local waterworks around and down, you know, down the water flow from the incident. One of the stories we did, you know, we checked in with Cincinnati Waterworks to see what they're testing for and what they found. And, you know, so far, so good. There is one chemical they detected. And at, you know, at the tiniest levels, way below where it would be a safety threat that matched what was in those rail cars. We actually have a list on Cincinnati.com of the chemicals that were in those cars. And that list actually grew from 10 hazardous materials to 11 just yesterday. So the more we dig in as journalists, and not just us, this is getting national attention, the more reporters dig in, the more we seem to find and the more questions we need to have answered. So, but yeah, you know, the basic timeline is that, you know, the incident occurred on February 3rd. The evacuation of those nearby communities happened shortly thereafter. They let residents back in after about a week. And now, you know, lawsuits have been filed. 5 or 6 lawsuits have been filed. There will probably be more. And it'll be interesting tonight as we speak, as we record this, will be the first time that citizens have face-to-face contact with officials to answer questions they might have or to hear, you know, what their plans are for remediation and long-term monitoring of health and water safety. Huge environmental story, and really opens up the question about, you know, our infrastructure, particularly all the materials that are that move along the rails. You know, how safe are we, especially people that live near major rail lines?
Do you know who lives near major rail lines?
A lot of people in Cincinnati.
Yeah. Exactly. And Norfolk Southern runs the rail through here. They are really at the center of a lot of things going on in Cincinnati because they want to buy the rail line that runs through Cincinnati and is owned by Cincinnati. And so you guys can watch for a lot more reporting on that coming from me in the coming days. But for now, we really are following exactly what's happening on the ground with my very, you know, my coworkers who, you know, went up there. I'm so proud of the work they're doing. Because, you know, I talked to Brooke Sutherland. He's our medical reporter. I talked to him yesterday, and he said that he can smell the chemicals. He is in a place where he can still smell the chemicals. But this reporting is so important to the state. I will say something locally to definitely watch for. There is a chemical plume coming in the Ohio River to Cincinnati. The water department said we're definitely safe right now, and they have a plan for the chemical plume, and we will be safe then. But I can promise you some really, you know, scrutinizing of what is actually happening with the water that everyone here will be drinking next week.
That's correct. And in addition to Brooke Sutherland, our photo director, Kara Owsley, is there. She's already photographed some images that were very eye-opening. And, you know, these are things the residents there are dealing with every day. It's easy for us on the other side of the state to not think about that. But, you know, it affects us all. Like you said, particularly in this part of the state, you can't drive more than a few miles without hitting a railroad crossing. And so, you know, we'll be on the story. We're partnering up with, you know, we're part of a network that includes the Columbus Dispatch, the Akron Beacon Journal, other sites, and we're committed to this story.
Okay. Well, this is how the beginning of, I feel like we're going to be talking about this at a lot more beginnings of That's So Cincinnati. And so you guys, we're going to move on to our special guest time because we know that he has very busy days and we don't want to keep him waiting. But thanks for reading on all of the things. You guys, it's right at the top of Cincinnati.com. You can find all of those stories on East Palestine, and there's a lot of them. Special guest time here on That's So Cincinnati. You know, a little bit of sports. Never hurt this podcast. We love talking about all things sports. We're going to pivot this week from the Bengals. I don't know if you know, we've been talking about that a lot. Over to UC with Cincinnati Director of Athletics, John Cunningham. Welcome, John.
Great to be with you guys. Thanks for having me on.
You know, what do you do all day? Nothing. There's so many things going on in your life.
It's, you know, that was going to be my question is, we hear about you, John, when there's turnover with coaches, things like that. But I'm sure you have a elevator pitch on what your job actually is. I think that might be the best place to start, because I frankly could benefit from understanding what is your 2-sentence job description?
This is a several word job description, which is head on a swivel is the way that I describe it, because there just seems to be, you know, a lot of different things coming at you on a daily basis as an athletics director, especially right now in this time frame that we're in college athletics. A lot of unknowns, a lot of things changing on a daily, weekly basis. And so, you know, that's what I always say. It's the great thing about my job is you come into work every day. You don't know exactly what's going to walk into your office or hit your table. But certainly I've got great people around me. We have great coaches, and it's energizing every day to be around young people and student athletes. And that's the best part about my job. So at its core, that's what we do, is we try to help young people develop and be great athletes, obviously, but also great citizens, and eventually give back to this community and other communities where they'll end up one day.
On the org chart, do the coaches report directly to you?
They do, yes. So we have, the way we structure it is, we do have what we call sport administrators for every sport. So they'll have people that they work directly with on my senior staff, but there is also a direct line to me. And so I have a AD head coach only meeting, every once a month, and we kind of dig in on some things. But I consider my head coaches to be part of my senior staff. But there, organizationally, I guess there is a report to a senior administrator as well. So sort of a dual report.
Before we jump into all the exciting things happening at UC, can you tell us how you got to this job? Like, what is a career path to running all the athletics at, what's now Big 12?
Mine went through law school, but it started, I always say it started with growing up in Lincoln, Nebraska in the 80s and 90s. And when you're part of a community like that, you see what college athletics can do around that community and how it can kind of lift it up. And so, there's no pro sports. There's not a whole lot going on entertainment wise outside of what the Nebraska Cornhuskers were doing. And so, when I grew up, I was going to volleyball games and soccer games and baseball games and obviously football and men's and women's basketball. So my heroes were college athletes. And so that kind of formed my opinion. And then from there, I ended up in law school, went to TCU, went back home to Lincoln to law school. And then about halfway through law school, I decided I didn't want to practice law every day. So that's not the best time to figure that out. But, it was a great education for me. I finished up law school and found my way into NCAA compliance. And since then, I've been at six different institutions and kind of made my way up and had some great mentors and people around me that saw something in me and helped me get to a position where I'm able to be the steward of this great athletics department at Cincinnati.
How long have you been in this role? What was your start date?
I started January 1 of 2020. So had 2.5 months of somewhat normalcy, and I started to put some things into place and really felt great about all the different things we were doing. And then the world sort of shut down a little bit on us. And so obviously college athletics was impacted by COVID, and we had a year where we didn't sell a ticket in Nippert or Fifth Third, and we had to adjust to that and just kind of like everybody else had to deal with what playing college athletics looked like during a global pandemic. And could we do it? How could we do it safely? How could we take care of the health of our student athletes and coaches and staff, and especially maybe now the reverberations of that is the mental health aspect of our student athletes and how are we taking care of them kind of post pandemic. I think a lot of people are dealing with that, and we certainly are as well. But so that my start was January 2020, and it's been a heck of a 3-year run.
So not selling a ticket to Nippert being completely sold out. Is that what's happening?
That's right. Yeah, we went. That's a great way to think about it, is we didn't sell a ticket, and then all of a sudden we're on a wait list for season tickets, and which I don't think we've ever been on previously. So to have that again, to have that run, especially in football, where we make it to the Peach Bowl, play Georgia, have Georgia on the ropes in that game, but then the next year to come back and to make it to the college football playoff and be the first ever non-Power 5 team to make it to that game and to really play an Alabama team and play that team in front of 16.5 million people on television. I mean, it was just a remarkable run for us, and obviously then led into the Big 12 and everything that we've got going forward.
Well, that's a great segue, because now if you make it back to the championship, you won't have that distinction of being a non-Power 5 team. Can you talk about what this means for the university and how that changes the dynamics of your job?
You know, from day one, that, you know, when I took over the job, it was the number one thing that I was asked about, which was, how do we break through and get ourselves in a position where we can be in a conference that gets the benefits that come with being in a Power Five. And obviously the obvious benefits are the financial benefits from the television rights deals that these conferences have. But there's also other benefits just in terms of prestige and exposure and all those other things that come along with it that benefit not just the athletics department, but they benefit the university and a community. And so, to break in when we did, you know, the announcement that we had in September of 2021, and then obviously joining the conference in July of 23 here coming up in just a few months, to be able to do that, it means so much to everybody that's been involved in this athletics department. We've put so much into it. There's been such an investment over years to make sure that if there ever was a possibility that we could find our way into one of these leagues, that we would be ready. And to have it happen was just special. Obviously, I said I'm just a steward of this thing, but it was impactful for a lot of our donors and obviously people on campus that have worked so hard and so long to get to that point. But the revenue, it will be 5x going forward year after year after year. And so that will mean a tremendous amount to our student athletes and to our university that's been subsidizing the athletics department for so long. It has reverberations well beyond just what we do on the field of play. It's gonna really impact our university for years to come.
What is it like getting ready for that? Like, that seems like it's happening now.
It is. And, you know, initially we weren't going to join the conference until July 24, and we were able to move that up. But so it's right around the corner, a few months away. We launched the campaign right when we found out we were going to be in the Big 12. We launched a campaign called Day One Ready, which was all about sort of an investment spin now to get ready to be able to compete against some of those institutions that for years have benefited from those TV revenues and have kind of built up their athletics departments and competed at this Power Five level. We've always felt like we've been able to, you know, kind of punch it up, you know, in terms of our weight class and really battle against teams that have had more. So kind of, you know, maximizing the resources that we had and outperforming our resources in many ways. So that's our DNA, and that will always kind of be in our DNA, I think. But certainly we also need to make sure that we've got the things that these other programs have, just in terms of facilities. We're building a brand new indoor practice facility. If you know where the bubble is on campus, we're going to take the bubble down. It served a purpose, but we're going to officially take that down in a couple weeks and start building an indoor practice facility and then what we call a performance center right next to it, which will be 100,000 square foot facility for our football team mostly, but we'll have a nutrition center for all of our student athletes in there, and all of our student athletes will use the indoor facility. So it's $120 million project that we've got going on, and we've raised a lot of money for it. We've had a lot of people step up, but that's just one example of an investment that we're making now to get ready. And we've got a lot of great people working on it.
When will that be finished? If we're breaking ground in a couple of weeks, how long is that going to take?
Yeah, they say a year build for the indoor portion of it, and then another 6 to 8 months build for the performance center next to it. And so the nice thing is that we will be able to get into the indoor while they're still completing the performance center. So, you know, we've We've kind of worked through some contingency plans to not have an indoor facility for a year, but you know, all of our sports are looking forward to that. That's used night and day, you know, during the cold weather for all of our sports. So we're excited to get in there in about a year.
Because in Cincinnati, you never know when it's going to be 0 degrees in December and in a random February day, 70, like today when we're recording.
I know we should be outside right now for sure. This is one of those beautiful days that you get here that that gives you a break from the winter, which is awesome.
So, not just to throw a bunch of softball questions at you, I want to ask you about the timing of Luke Fickell's decision to leave the University of Cincinnati, having to do a search for a new head football coach who will start his first season as the Bearcats start Big 12 play. I'm guessing that wasn't the ideal script that you would have put in place for a transition like that. Can you talk about what that was like from your role as athletic director?
It wasn't the ideal script. I mean, there's no question about it, but it goes back to maybe my beginning statement of head on a swivel. You've got to be ready in college athletics. You know, you see movement all the time in the college circles. But I just go back to everything that Coach Fickell did in a 6-year period of time for this institution and this athletics department, and have the utmost respect, obviously, for him and him as a coach, and really, I've always said this, him as a person, but to be able to move the needle so much and really get us an opportunity to be in the Power Five, I can't thank him enough. But you know, decisions are made, and so you've got to adjust, and you've got to go quickly, try to find the best fit for the University of Cincinnati, and that's what I told the team when I met with them. Their heads are spinning as young people. Their coach just left, and I stand in front of them and I said, I'm going to find the best fit for you. And don't pay attention to what the outside world says. It's going to feel like forever. We did a search in a very strategic time frame, 7 to 10 day time frame. But I said, it's going to feel like forever. And it did. But I said, we're going to find the best fit for you. I'm going to bring you a coach and put this coach in front of you. And I ask you to lock arms with this coach and move forward. And I give them a lot of credit too. Again, young people having to go through a lot of transition, but they believe in the University of Cincinnati and they really love this place. And I was so happy to present Coach Satterfield to them. You know, this is somebody that built a culture and a program and a winning culture at App State for many years. Won conference championships there, went on to Louisville and took over a program that had not won a ACC game, I think was 2-10, and took it to 3 bowl games in 4 years and really started to shift that program in his time there, and was able to beat, you know, some of the top teams in the country, top 10 team last year. So he's seen it at the highest level. He understands the type of football you've got to play. He's an offensive mind, has called plays for, you know, 15 years or more at a Division I level, and just somebody that you know, we really believed in and just had a presence about him. So we were excited to introduce him to the team, and you move on and you go forward, and he's got a great staff around him, and we're excited about the future.
So he was hired December 5th, and he's really just getting off the ground right now, right? I bet his days are long.
His days are long. You know, he jumps right into the world of recruiting and the transfer portal and everything that we're going through in college athletics, where there's free transfer now. It used to be that you couldn't transfer without sitting out a year before being eligible, and that's not the case anymore. So you see a lot more transfers. And so when he took over right there in December, he's trying to really build out his roster. He's trying to understand the talent that he has on the team, and then fill in where needed. But you know, the movement of college athletes around to different schools certainly played into to what he and his staff had to navigate during a very short period of time. So a lot of recruiting. Now he's finally getting into the world of putting into place, you know, the offense and defense and everything that you got to do with the new team. Spring practice starts in a few weeks. And so I feel like he's in the mode that every coach likes to be in, which is coaching football. It's all the other things that cause them probably more heartburn, but they all love to coach the team. And I think he's really excited to get out on the field with these young men and get to know them and coach ball.
Do you think the transfer portal is ultimately a good thing for college athletics?
I don't. I don't necessarily think it's wrong to be able to allow students to transfer freely. That's not, but I think the way it's being used now and in combination with the world that we exist in with NIL, and what I call synthetic NIL, which is NIL that's being kind of produced synthetically by these groups of donors. And so you almost have this bidding war that's taking place where students are being pulled from other teams based on financial commitments. I just truly believe that a lot of people are being brought into our world that don't have the best interest of the students in mind. And there's something special to me with spending time at a university. I think about the Kelsey brothers and others, but spending time at a university and really ingraining yourself into that community, that doors open for you. And when we bring back a basketball player from the 90s and we introduce him at halftime of a basketball game, this community embraces that person. And there's so many examples of student athletes that either have stayed in Cincinnati and found their way into our workforce, or have left, done great things and have given back, but they always feel the draw back to Cincinnati and the fact that they have a home here. And I feel like that's something that these young people are going to lose by transferring to 2 to 3 schools. They'll never really ingrain themselves into the community. And that's really something special about college athletics. And when I talked about growing up in Nebraska, just some of those individuals that stayed in Nebraska and really made a life for themselves. And it started with their connection to the athletics program there. And I see that and feel it at the University of Cincinnati as well. And I just don't want that to be lost. So we've got a lot of work to do as an industry to get this thing figured out and kind of settle the waters a little bit. And I think it will. But that's something that I think we got to talk more about to these young people that you know, having those deep ties to a community is really important.
So on the subject of those student athletes, we're really I don't think anyone understands like how this is really going to change things, although there's been a lot of speculation, name, image, and likeness. How much is that driving athletes' decisions to stay in a place rather than the idea of community? Is that like making people kind of switch around in search of what's going to get people the highest profile?
You know, it's hard to tell how many students are leaving for that reason or leaving for other reasons, you know, and so it's really difficult to tell right now. I think there is a little bit that's going on that you don't necessarily like to see, you know, where student athletes are making a strictly financial decision. I think that's probably a pretty small number, to be honest with you, but it is happening. So I think what's going to happen eventually is this thing, you know, this is brand new for everybody. So it started out allowing student athletes to use their name, image, and likeness to profit. It was mostly a business to student athlete contract, which made a lot of sense. The best student athletes on the best teams had an opportunity, like our Olympic athletes have for years, to go out and do marketing and promotions and make some money off of that. That's how it started. It's gone into something that's different than that, where it's groups of donors that have come together in these collectives and have built these collectives out to essentially use student athletes as marketers for the collective and then paying them. And that's created just disruption, significant disruption in our industry. And so we're all trying to figure it out. I do think there's a settling that takes place. I think there's some guidelines and some things that the NCAA will do in the near future with some new leadership that will help put some guardrails. That's the popular term. Put some guardrails around what's going on right now. And then there's also the possibility of getting some relief from federal legislation, because there's several pieces of federal legislation that's out there right now and being discussed to try to put some guardrails around what's happening. But it's just a time of disruption. I think that it's going to take some great leadership from us in the top, and we will figure it out eventually.
Do you worry about parity? Not that there's, you know, there's always the perennial powerhouses. There's always the schools that generate a ton of money. But there's always the hope that a smaller program, us Cincinnati, for example, can squeak into the championship round. Do you think that that's going to be more difficult now moving forward with not just NIL, but particularly the transfer portal?
You know, I don't think it's going to change it. I really don't. I've thought a lot about this. That's a great question. And the reason why I don't think it changes is because what I sort of talked about in terms of the community and being able to recruit in your community, have them stay, retention of student athletes that do great things. I still believe, you know, at Cincinnati, our bread and butter is within a 300-mile radius of our campus. And if we have great coaches and we're doing tremendous things around the student athlete, you know, we've got a student athlete leadership and development academy that's all about making sure that every student athlete that leaves here either has a job lined up or has grad school, or they're going to play professionally somewhere and continue in athletics. We want every single one of our student athletes that leaves to be able to do that. So we're trying to make sure that we're building a full-scale approach to the student athlete experience. And if you do that, then I think that you can continue to compete, even if your NIL dollars aren't the same as they are in other places around the country. And so that's something that I feel strongly about. Doesn't mean that we won't have a strong NIL program. We certainly will have that. I still think that you can build that way and compete that way. We traditionally haven't gotten the five-star recruit anyway, you know, and we've built around developing talent and local talent, and we've been able to compete again nationally. And so I see that as continuing for the University of Cincinnati.
Every response you have, I think about 10 follow-up questions, and we don't have a lot of time, but I do want to ask you, you mentioned the sweet spot of recruiting for the University of Cincinnati being about a 300-mile radius. How would you compare that geographical area to programs in the SEC where, you know, most people think that, you know, that's the hotbed of where the talent is? How would you compare our region as far as raw talent coming out of high school?
I think it's as strong as anywhere in the country. And, you know, I think the evidence is that everybody is trying to recruit Ohio high school students and Kentucky high school students and Indiana high school students. So I think the high school programs that we have are tremendous. The high school coaches that we have are tremendous. We offer a lot. We offer an identity, I think, which is kind of a tough, gritty mindset that really obviously plays well in athletics. And so I think as long as we can continue to embrace that and adopt that, and we're gonna recruit the heck out of this area and have those gritty kids, and I'll put them up against anybody in the country.
Did you play sports in high school?
I did play sports in high school. Yeah, my career ended in high school. Yeah, I played some basketball. I set a lot of picks. And I was a serviceable defender, and that's about it. But I played some basketball, and then golf was my other sport. I probably should have put more time into golf and less into everything else. But those are the two that I participated in.
I would guess that being proficient on the golf course is helpful for someone in your job when it comes to meeting with prospective donors for the program and things like that.
You know, I play about 7 times a year now, and it's all in like scrambles that are, you know, 6-hour long days. But it's a lot of fun to be out there with people that you love to play with and meet new people. But I wish I could have more time to play. That's for sure.
All right. So we cannot let you go without talking about the Kelce brothers. So you know them, right?
Yeah, I do. You know, had a chance to meet Travis. Have not had a chance to meet Jason, but certainly hear a lot about him. But they're just incredible, incredible people, incredible ambassadors for our athletics department. You know, obviously we're really proud of them. It was kind of a soft landing for Bengals Bearcats fans to, you know, the Bengals didn't make it, but you got to cheer for both of the Kelce brothers, and just who they are as people and as ambassadors. And you know, the amazing thing is they're both going to be Hall of Famers. You know, I mean, Travis gets a lot of that Hall of Fame look ahead, but Jason's right there. Jason is one of the best centers of all time, and just the leadership, the stories that you hear about them here are great. You know, just how they were leaders here, leaders in the community. But I had a really interesting conversation with Walt Stewart, who is on our football staff that played with Jason Kelce. And he told me that Jason was the best student athlete leader he's ever been around. And if he could have a group of Jason Kelce's, that they could do some really special things, because Jason kept everybody accountable, came every day to the campus and worked his butt off. And you can see it out there. That's the type of person that he is. So anyway, just the stories that float around this campus about those two just tell you the type of people they are. And then they both, which is really special, they both given back. You know, they both given back to the program in significant ways. And that's been really special too.
I do think it gets back to your point of community. They're there for 4 years. They were there together, and you connect to the community, and they still have that today. It's important to us. It seems important to them. And it's time that just builds that.
That's right. They're Bearcats forever, and Cincinnati feels that way. So it's fun to see it play out on a national stage and then have them talk about the Bearcats and remember what we did for them and then what they're now doing for us. It's a great relationship.
So I haven't paired up the NFL schedule with the college football schedule, but because we love when podcast guests break news, you have the Big 12 opener against Oklahoma at home on September 23rd. Will the Kelce brothers be there?
I don't know. Anytime they want to come back, they know that they're welcome. We'll like I talked about bringing back our old basketball student athletes at halftime. We'll certainly have the Kelce's back and obviously recognize them and celebrate them. So anytime we can get them back, we'll take them. It'd be awesome to have them back for that game, obviously, as the opener of the Big 12. You know, schedule. We've talked about that Oklahoma game being unique. There's only been 14 teams that have made the college football playoff, and two of those 14 are Cincinnati and Oklahoma. And obviously the deep history of the Sooners and you know what they've been able to do. I've followed them forever and respect them tremendously. So to have that be the game that opens up Big 12 play in Nippert is really awesome.
All right, I think we have to let you go. Although, I mean, we could keep talking, Burl.
We could. I have many more questions, but this is going to have to do. John, we can't thank you enough for being on the podcast today. I, as a alum of the University of Cincinnati, I can't, and I graduated in the late 80s. I can't tell you what it's like. And also, out of the market 12 years, to come back and see the transformation on the campus, the excitement around all the sports, particularly football, in recent years. And I think I speak for many graduates that are having a newfound sense of pride around all of this. And it's just been phenomenal from my perspective. And so we thank you for being on the podcast today, letting us ask you some grilling questions, and wish you luck this season.
Well, thank you. We'd love to hear that and that pride, and we'll continue to drive the brand locally and nationally, and go Bearcats. Good to be with you guys.
Go Bearcats. You guys, I have to tell you, some of my favorite guests on That's So Cincinnati, I walk away having learned something. Now, of course, I'm not some expert in like athletics and everything, but I learned a lot from that. And I love when I can have a conversation. And how many more questions do you think we could have asked, Burl? 100, 500, 1,000?
You know, you're right. The question that I wish I would have asked is, and I, you know, he has to be very diplomatic. He just hired a brand new football coach, but if there is continued success in the Bearcat football program, will we be in the same position in a few years where our coach moves on to greener pastures like Luke Fickle did, like Brian Kelly did before him? Although I have to say Luke Fickle's exit was much more professional and shall we say less shady than Brian Kelly's infamous exit when he went to Notre Dame. But does moving into the Big 12 mitigate that some? Are we now not going to be a stepping stone, but will we be more of a final destination for the best coaches?
I have to say, I feel like because we're like a smaller school in the Big 12, that when we're successful, those bigger schools might come calling.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't think that mitigates the situation at all. It might make it worse, but you know, time will tell. Time will tell. I think that's the only way we can answer that.
So, I have a question for you.
All right.
Now, I've done this in the past. First of all, I should say I'm dieting, okay? But I'm always very popular on the years that I drive to Indiana and go buy cherry thing-a-lings. Do I do it this year, eat like half of one, but then make everyone in my life super happy, including you?
So I was guilty of not even knowing about cherry thing-a-lings until you did that a few years ago.
Oh my God, they're so, like, I don't know. And I, you know, pastries, right? But like going there and getting them fresh, there's nothing compares to that.
Well, and now I went from being completely oblivious about it to when I see that it, you know, President's Day is coming up on the calendar. Not that anybody really celebrates it unless they have the day off, but when I see that, I think that, oh, it's cherry thing-a-ling time. So tell us, Sherry, since you have been to Batesville, Indiana, to go to Schmidt Bakery, what is so damn special about these things?
So first of all, they're on sale only like this one time a year. I think it's like 4 days, Thursday through Sunday, because I wouldn't be able to go till the weekend. And I have gone early. But I don't know what time the first person gets in line. But I mean, I've been there by like 7, 6:30. It's, you know, it's an hour. I live on the West Side, like 45 minutes an hour. But the last time I went, I had to wait in line for 2 hours in like 2-degree weather. Now, I'd have to say I did plan ahead and I was, you know, warm and toasty. But I did. Once you're there, what do you do? Be like, oh, the line's 2 hours? No, you get in it and you wait. I couldn't let it go and turn around and come home. So the line is long because everybody knows the secret that we're just talking about is how good they are. And this is not just a thing that, you know, that we have here and we say, oh, it's so good. They really are very special and people come from all over. I mean, I think I talked to someone who drove from like 2 hours away while I was, you know, you make friends with the people in the line
right.
And talk. But as I'm saying all this, I do have to say my dad just moved here from, well, Youngstown. I think I have to take him this year. I'm going to have to go.
I think you're going to have to go.
Swing by, pick him up in Sailor Park and head on out.
So for the uninitiated, would you describe them as like a small donut or a fritter?
They're definitely, I mean, they're, anyone who does it has never had one before be like, oh, that's a cherry fritter. So it is very much like a cherry fritter. I think okay. It's just that it's a special recipe for them. And they, you know, like to put everything on Instagram. They are the least photographic things in the entire world. Everyone is like, why are you posting pictures of like chicken, like fried chicken?
Yeah, they look like the picture that we have with our story right now on Cincinnati.com. They remind me of like, sweet and sour, not sweet and sour chicken.
Yes, maybe sweet yes.
What's the chicken? The fried, it's fried, battered, and it has that like
popcorn.
Very like pink red sauce. That's sweet and sour chicken, right?
Yeah.
It sort of looks like sweet and sour chicken, but they are fritters. And I guess the connection to President's Day, which is really George Washington's birthday, is the legend of George Washington chopping down the cherry tree. So there's a tie-in to cherries. But I think it is so Cincinnati that people drive from all points around Batesville, Indiana, wait in a 2-hour line to get fritters.
It's
think
worth
about
it.
That. And you've done it. You've done it.
Yes.
Well, that's another reason you're so Cincinnati, but that's why we love you, Sherry.
I know. I might have to convince you and Lauren to go with me. We'll see. We're going to start making some plans now.
All right. Well, you know, there's lots of food news this week. We don't have time to get into it, but we also have a story about a Frisch's Big Boy sandwich-inspired pizza. So if cherry thing-a-lings aren't your thing, thing-a-lings aren't your thing-a-ling, and you prefer something a little more savory and unusual, I guess this pizza has, you know, ground beef like hamburger, pickles, and what would it require, Sherry, if it's really a Big Boy sandwich style pizza?
I don't know. And I read the
tartar
story.
Sauce,
tartar
Sherry.
Sauce, the tartar sauce.
Tartar sauce on a pizza. Think about that.
No.
No.
Although
no.
I have to say, you know what I love? Pickle pizza.
Pickle pizza's good. Yeah. I've had pickle pizza before. And I'm warming up to pineapple on pizza. I'm broadening my pizza horizons a bit, but I'm not sure if I'm ready for tartar sauce on a pizza.
You have to
and
do
I know
it
I'm
for
gonna
the
get
good.
Hate.
You have to do it for the good of the podcast next week, Burl.
Maybe we can do a video version of the podcast where you look at my face when I try tartar sauce on a pizza. It just doesn't seem right, but I'm gonna keep an open mind because you have to when it comes to the culinary scene in Cincinnati. So
absolutely, that's no true statement.
All right. Well, let's call it a podcast, Sherry.
And we're out, you guys.
Thanks.